Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This is NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for a vacationing Carrie Miller. Close your eyes and picture a great leader. You probably see somebody who is a great speaker with natural charisma, an extrovert, a superstar talent. Sam Walker would like you to rethink that entire model. His new book is called The Captain Class, The Hidden Force That Creates the World's Greatest Teams. Walker wanted to figure out how the best teams in sports history became the best teams in sports history. It's a really fun read, but it will also make you look at your favorite teams differently and look at your own workplace differently. Now, I started by asking him how he narrowed down to his list of the 16 greatest teams of all time.
It was tough because there is no roadmap. No one had ever tried to do this before. There had never been an objective, comprehensive and really empirical look at the best teams of all time. So before I could even start evaluating the teams, you know, I had to answer some fundamental questions like, what is a team? You know, is a team where the athletes compete under the same uniform, but individually, like a boxing team? Is that a team? And then there were questions of how many people do you need to have a team as opposed to, say, a pair or a partnership or a trio? So I had to answer some of those questions, which helped narrow down the sports a little bit. But ultimately, I realized what I wanted to study was I wanted to find not just greatness, but lasting greatness. I wanted to find the dynasties that had ruled all over the world. And I knew that most of the lists I'd seen were kind of parochial. I mean, it was one nation or one sport or and they didn't really look at the entirety of sports in the history of the world. So what I did was look at every single winning team in sports history in 37 categories of sports since the 1880s. And it was that just getting that list together was crazy. So anyway, I got that list together and then I started weeding them out. And really the ultimate weeders were I came up with a definition of excellence that they had to meet. And I got it down to 122 teams, and then there was one last hurdle, which is that to be the best team of all time, you had to be able to make this claim. I believed you have to be able to say that your accomplishments are something that no one has ever matched in the history of your sport. They have to be unique.
Okay.
And really, that was the big weeder, and that was a brutal bar that knocked off a lot of very famous teams that we all know and love and expect to be in there. But in the end, there were 16 teams that got over the bar. And here's the thing. I love this debate. I love having this debate. I can have it with anyone in the world about any sport now because I'm a geek about this stuff now. But that wasn't the point. I mean, the point was I wanted a pure sample. I wanted a sample of teams where there's just no way. They're unambiguously outstanding. There's nothing about them that could be questioned. And that was the sample I wanted to use to study the other question, the larger question, the one I was really after, which is what is the DNA of a great team? What do they all have in common? What's the one thing, the two things, the three things that have to be there, the foundational blocks upon which a dynasty is built?
So let me read this list of teams because I'm sure there are listeners who've never heard of some of these.
I hadn't either.
Yeah, the Collingwood Magpies, Australian rules football from 1927 to 30, New York Yankees from 49 to 50, Hungary soccer 50 to 55, New Zealand All Blacks, who are going to make a second appearance from 86 to 90, and that's rugby, in case you didn't know. Cuba International Women's Volleyball from 1991 to 2000. That's a long
streak. The best Olympic team of all time, by the way. And I had no idea. I'd never heard of them.
I was looking back at some footage of them, and they're incredible. Amazing. Australia International Women's Field Hockey and U.S. Women's Soccer Team from 96 to 99. San Antonio Spurs National Basketball League from 97 to 16. Barcelona Professional Soccer, 2008 to 13. France International Handball from 2008 to 15. And New Zealand All Blacks Rugby once again from 2011 to 15. All right, well, there's a list. So how did you start examining what made these teams the greatest? Was it the coaches, the money? I mean, how do you even start?
That's the thing. I didn't know where to start, so I started with my prejudices and what I thought would be the answers. I started with talent. Mm-hmm. I assumed they had superstar talent or an overall level of talent that was better than anyone else. And then the thing I really thought would be the answer was coaching. I thought coaching was the thing, brilliant coaching, or the coaches that they had fell into some sort of discernible pattern. And if it wasn't that, my next ones were tactics, brilliant tactics, or money, just financial resources.
Yeah.
better than everyone else. So I started digging into these things, and as I dug into them, I realized something incredible, which is none of those qualities applied even to a majority of those teams. I mean, some of them had really mediocre talent. Some had great talent. Some had great coaches. Some had two coaches or lousy coaches or, you know, some other coaching situation that wasn't ideal. And, you know, tactics didn't matter. Money didn't matter at all. Look at Cuba and Hungary and some of these teams from really kind of impoverished countries that have been great. So none of that worked. There was only one thing, and it was so slap your forehead obvious that I didn't believe it was true at first. It just seemed too simple, which is that if you look at the dynasty and its beginning and its end, it corresponded precisely in most cases to the career of one player, the arrival and departure of one person. And that person was always either eventually or would become the captain of the team. And it was right there. I saw it over and over again. And even in the next tier of teams, the ones that weren't in the top 16, I saw the same pattern. It was one person, and it was the leader of the player. So the only conclusion I could draw from this research was really a simple one, which is if you want a team that lasts, a team that has enduring greatness, you have to have the central figure, and the central figure is the leader of the players.
Okay, so what do captains on these teams do, on professional teams or in like an Olympic team? What do they do?
You know, it really varies a lot depending on the sport. A lot of them have a ton of responsibility for helping tactically on the field. And some, you know, it's more ceremonial. It's more of a it's something where they're really expected to just kind of set the tone and work with the younger players and sort of do some of the leadership management tasks in the locker room. But really, I think the one thing they all have in common is that they are the people in these cases who created the sort of collective identity of the team. And in all of these cases, these captains did that. And what was amazing about them is that you said it at the open that you have this picture in your head of a captain, right? A superstar, someone with charisma, with obvious talent, someone whose exceptional qualities are apparent to everyone. But what I found was the complete opposite. Some of these captains, I knew the team really well. I didn't even have any idea who the captain was. I'd never heard of them. And that was not an accident, because these captains were rarely stars. They were usually water carriers. They did the grunt work for the team. They played in defensive positions. They hated attention. They didn't want individual accolades. They didn't give speeches. They weren't charismatic. They weren't interested in being celebrities. They were also really difficult to manage, which surprised me. And they would introduce conflict in the team. They would push back on anything they didn't like, and sometimes they pushed the rules to the absolute breaking point in competition. So they were, in short, I didn't know I was writing a book about management or leadership when I started this project. And then when I found that I was completely just gobsmacked, to use a word, by the fact that my preconceptions, prejudices about leadership are totally wrong, and that the actual style that creates enduring success was something completely different.
Yeah, when you started looking at the captains you wrote, you found that their traits made them appear at best to have, quote, seriously warped priorities. At worst, it suggested they were out of their minds. I mean, give us an example of someone doing something that appears to be seriously warped, but it was planful or worked to move the team forward.
Well, the cringiest one, which I shouldn't tell, but I will tell.
Oh, please.
Is Buck Shelford. He was the captain of the New Zealand All Blacks in the late 80s. And before he was captain, right when he made the team, he played against France. And back then in the late 80s, rugby was a mess. I mean, they hadn't cleaned it up. It was still a really, really violent sport. And the French were very proud of it and were known as one of the dirtier teams. So the New Zealand came in to play two matches against France, and they just crushed the French in the first match. And the second match, this was Shelford's second test with the team, and they were after him because he'd been the star of the first game. And early on, he got punched in the face, lost three teeth. Then he got knocked unconscious by someone who took a dive right into a pile of players and hit him in the head. Someone sucker punched him and tried to bait him into a fight. And finally, he got kicked in the groin by one of the French players, intentionally, of course. So he kept playing. Throughout this, he just kept playing and playing and playing, and they were losing the match. And, you know, ultimately, he got another blow to the head and had a concussion, and they took him out of the match, and sort of reluctantly even then. But after the match, this was astonishing. So he was getting undressed in the locker room, and he took off his uniform, and there was a pool of blood on the floor. And I don't want to get any more graphic than this.
Please,
but
yeah.
He had been kicked in the, not just kicked in the groin, but the spikes of the other player's boot had ripped him open in a sensitive place, and things were, you know, not where they should be. And he had played through that injury, which you just think about that. I mean, 99.9% of the male population would crawl whimpering into the back of an ambulance the minute that happened. But he was so relentless and so focused, he hadn't even realized what had gone on. And that's an extreme case. But what I saw was this incredible relentlessness. And it was they would play hard and play well through the most incredible things, whether it was a broken foot or a heart attack in one case. Of this hockey player had a heart attack during a world championship game and kept playing. But it was also emotional strength. I mean, they played through some of the most unimaginable situations. You know, a parent at home in the hospital dying of cancer, you know, with days to live and playing not just well, but playing spectacularly. So they show this kind of level of commitment to the team that at times really was beyond what could be considered normal.
And that translated, and they took that as inspiration to see your teammate bleeding in the changing room afterwards. That was inspiring, and not seeing as whoa, something wrong with
him. Well, I think it was a little both in Shelford's case, but it took me a long time to figure that out, because as I said, I saw that and I heard about this incident and I thought he was crazy. But what I realized, I did a lot of studies on this and looked at a lot of studies in behavioral psychology, and there's a famous experiment that was done in the early 20th century that showed something called social loafing. And the idea is that people will work harder on a task individually by themselves. If you put them in a group to do the same thing, they won't work quite as hard. And it's this idea that it kind of explains why sometimes teams don't really add up to the sum total of their parts, because people aren't pulling as hard as they would by themselves.
And you know the other person's doing their bit, and if they're not working that hard, you don't have to work that hard.
Right, exactly. But so the reverse also applies. And there was another experiment done where before they put these people in the group context, they said, this person on your team is a high-effort performer, always gives an amazing effort. Just the perception that someone is giving it their full effort would raise the whole team's performance. So the idea is that hard work and effort and commitment at that level is contagious. It has an immediately contagious effect on a collective group. And that is what you saw over and over again. It was that they played hard, whether they were up 10-0, down 50-0. It didn't matter. They were running around as if, you know, the game was on the line. And that level of energy and effort is something that is really irreplaceable. And it's a good lesson for all of us, not just in sports, but in business. I mean, rolling up your sleeves and getting involved and just working hard can have a really positive impact on everyone around you.
And they made sure that everybody else knew it. They would yell at their teammates and be out there like, you got to work harder, at even times when a team was winning by an outstanding amount. And if one of the teammates was kind of slacking off because they were winning, the captains would yell at them and say, work harder. You can't lean back now.
Well, Carlos Puyol, who is the captain of Barcelona, the great soccer team, which makes an appearance in the top 16, is one of my favorite characters. But that's what his teammates said. I mean, they would be throttling some poor team from, you know, some lowly Spanish team, and they'd be beating them 10-0. And he's running around like it's a Champions League final. And he's calling everyone, you know, for the throw-ins, and he's getting on his teammates' case if they're sort of just losing focus. And he was a great example of that. Yeah, they would really be on people to make sure that they were focused and that helped.
But they don't it's not that they're superstars. It's not that they're the greatest. It's not that they're Michael Jordan. They're not excelling as a superstar. They're just tireless and willing to, and in his case on Barcelona, he'd just be running around while everyone else was super smooth player, and he was kind of just nonstop.
Yeah, he was probably the worst player on the team in terms of skill, just aggregate skill. But, you know, he was the one who took all the shots to the face and, you know, would get knocked around by the other team's forwards. I mean, he just, you know, it was a willingness to sacrifice himself, which he did over and over again. And they all did. But, you know, there was more to it than that. It's not just effort. I mean, one of the things that really stands out about all these captains is that they were not superstars. And I didn't understand this. I thought that a leader, the definition of leadership is you take the shot with the game on the line, right?
Yeah.
You're the person who wins. And it never made any sense to me. So after talking to a lot of these captains, I realized that, you know, we don't really see leadership sometimes on the field. We're always looking at the forward play, what's happening, where the ball is, who's doing something, you know, at the front of the field. But what we don't understand is that by playing back and playing defense, and in soccer, it's about distributing the ball to teammates, or it's about being in a position where you can talk to the entire team. It's about having short individual conversations with people of high intensity, where you talk and listen and correct problems in the moment. It's all the little things that you do inside a team. And what Didier Deschamps, who was the captain of the great French soccer team, told me, now the national team coach, he said, you know, what you don't understand is that you need your teammates when you're a support player, but your teammates also need you. And they need you to get the ball to them, and they need you to do the grunt work on their behalf to allow them to be stars. And so what I realized was that playing in the back and playing at the back is a kind of counterintuitive form of command, and that really these people were able to control their teams and to lead, even though they didn't look like they were leading. It wasn't apparent to the people in the stands.
Yeah, tell us about Carla Overbeck, because I didn't recognize her name, and she was on the U.S. women's team. This incredibly famous team, and I know other players' names, Mia Hamm, but she was the captain, and she, like you said, led from behind. She would never try to make goals, really, even if she had the chance.
She's my favorite party trick because no one remembers her name. And there's a reason. The thing is, I realize there's a reason for this because Carla Overbeck didn't care if you knew who she was. She was really an exceptional leader, and that team has since had a nice string of great leadership, I think. But it all started with Carla. Now, here was Carla's situation. Again, she was nowhere near the best player on that team, probably in terms of talent, one of the lowest on the team. And she was a defender, a midfielder, or a defensive midfielder, and she would, the minute she got the ball, she would immediately lay it off to a teammate because she knew her teammates were better athletes than her. She didn't ever try to score, do anything flashy. But she understood that that increased the team's chances of winning because the ball was at the feet of a superior player. But what she did that was really incredible was she just stepped out of the spotlight completely. In fact, she would make it clear that she was a servant of the team. And my favorite anecdote about Carla Overbeck is that this team would go on long road trips. They'd fly to Norway, and they'd be exhausted, and they'd get to their hotel room, and there'd be a knock on the door, and they would open the door, and it's Carla Overbeck who's carrying their bags from the bus to their room for them. She's the captain of the team. So I asked her former coach, I said, why did she do that? And he said, you know, she did that on purpose. That was intentional because what she was doing was creating a form of currency where her teammates understood that she was not – her ego and her needs were completely subordinated to what was good for the team. So when she was on the field and someone was unfocused or made a mistake, she would get on them immediately. And the thing is, they knew where it was coming from. It wasn't an ego thing or a personal thing. They knew that she cared about the team more than anything else, that her leadership was genuine and collective. And over again, I saw these acts of service and selflessness. They had this effect on the teammates where they understood this person's genuine. They care about the collective success of the team more than themselves. And that kind of leadership is really infectious because it allows everyone to relax in a way, especially the stars. The stars can go do their thing and be stars and get all the credit and soak up the limelight. So in the 99 team, Mia Hamm, Julie Foudy, you know, Brandi Chastain, these really telegenic, famous women on that team, they were all on Letterman and having a parade in Midtown Manhattan. Where was Carla Overbeck? She flew home. She didn't want anything to do with it. She said she did laundry while they were all, you know, having this big celebration. And she wasn't being rude. Her job was to win a trophy. And when that was done, she wanted nothing else. And that was something that allowed everyone on the team to perform better.
Yeah, you even made me like the stoic Tim Duncan of the Spurs, who always seemed impenetrable to me and really not interested in being a star or giving interviews or saying much. And Bill Russell, another great that you write about, said that he admired Tim Duncan because he played the game without the ball, and he gave up the ball a lot to his teammates. And what did he mean by that, he played without the ball?
Well, Tim Duncan was a superstar talent, and that's kind of rare in this group because most of them weren't. He had the talent. He could have scored 30 points a game and been the NBA's leading scorer if he wanted to. But what's fascinating about Duncan is if you look at his statistics, it's like a diary of what was going on with the Spurs. There are seasons where they had a lot of offense, and you know, so his scoring went down, his defense went up. There were times where he had, didn't have a great supporting cast and they weren't scoring. So his offense would go up and his defensive totals would go down. Tim Duncan didn't care about his numbers. He did whatever had to be done to make the team better. He switched positions. He was completely flexible. He did that grunt work. He had that service mentality. And, you know, that extended to everything he did. If you look at the way he talks in interviews, it looks like he's having a colonoscopy, right? And he's miserable. He hates it. He hated attention. Hated individual accolades, didn't care about individual awards. But what he did was when he was with that team, his personality was different. He communicated in the way they all communicated, which is they did not give speeches. Not one of these captains gave big locker room speeches. You think that's the key to motivation in sports. It's not. What Duncan did was he was comfortable approaching everyone on the team. He would walk around, circulate. He would talk to everyone individually, very intensely, short bursts, listening as much as he spoke with this intensity. He would correct problems in the moment, and he created this environment where everyone could talk and felt comfortable talking. And the Spurs are famous for this. They talk on the floor more than any other NBA team. They correct problems when they happen rather than letting them fester. And that kind of communication makes them a much stronger team. And it was all because of Duncan and his style of leadership. But his teammates said, look, if you walked into the practice and you were asked who's the leader of this team, you would never imagine that it was Duncan because he had none of the traits that we associate with leadership.
I'm Stephanie Curtis, and I'm talking with Sam Walker. His new book is called The Captain Class, The Hidden Force That Creates the World's Greatest Teams. So the captain of the team not only deals with the team, they also deal with management. And how do they balance in between the players and management? Are they kind of the person who talks back to management and sticks up for the team, or are they the person who enforces management's rules on the team?
What's interesting is they do whatever is necessary. And sometimes they'll stand up against their teammates. I found cases where they would say things, even publicly, that really rankled some of their teammates about the team's play. And they totally clash with management at every level. I mean, in fact, they've got this almost instinctive radar for anything they think is getting in the way of winning, and they will push back immediately. They're fiercely independent in that way, and they're also courageous because, you know, as we know, it's difficult to stand against a group and to push back on something that everyone else is comfortable with. And
it is. It's
a tough thing to do, and they would do it constantly. They didn't care about the impact on them. They didn't care if it resulted in them being sent to a different team or if their teammates turned on them, which they didn't. By the way, because what happens with these players is that they understand conflict. And we don't really understand conflict on teams. A lot of sports teams will get rid of someone for agitating. You know, they'll call them a clubhouse lawyer is a term for it. And they'll get rid of them because they think they're a problem. So, but what they don't realize is there's two kinds of conflict. And we don't differentiate between them. There's personal conflict, which is someone who's creating conflict or dissent or drama based on the fact that they just don't like somebody. It's personal. It's ego-driven. But then there's another form of conflict, which the psychologists call task conflict. That is when the argument is completely 100% centered on what the team is doing and what it needs to do to get better. And that was the study that really made me understand this, because in every case, the dissent and the conflict that I saw these players create inside their teams was always about winning, always about what the team was doing. And it was never personal, and it never ventured into personal, even when it seemed like it was personal. I mean, this hockey player from Russia, from that team we were talking about before, actually choked his coach once and threatened to throw him out of an airplane for bad-mouthing some of his teammates. And that seemed like the quintessential example of personal conflict. But, you know, the next day showed up at practice, said, "Hey, coach," you know, and continued to do whatever it is that he was doing. And that is the difference. It wasn't personal. It was about holding the team together. And, you know, sometimes we just don't look at someone's motivations for doing this, and we don't understand that it's constructive and not destructive. And there is a kind of conflict that actually helps teams get better.
Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about someone that I think you have great affection for, And I just want to dig into Bill Russell right now. Tell us about Bill Russell.
Bill Russell was a player for the Boston Celtics, and he arrived in 1957 and left in 1969. And over the course of his time in Boston, he would become the captain of the team. Later was the player coach for his last three seasons. And Bill Russell, over that span, those Celtics teams won 11 championships in 13 seasons.
Wow.
It is the absolute most amazing run I've ever seen in the history of sports. I've never seen a team dominate like that for so long. And the only constant on that team was Bill Russell. It started the year he showed up, and it ended the year he left. And, you know, that was the first thing that clued me into captaincy. Now, Bill Russell was an amazing case. He was a real puzzle for the public, not just in Boston, but everywhere. It was a very fraught time in American history. The civil rights movement, you know, was going on, and there was a lot of strife. And this was a mixed-race team that had its own tensions along those lines. And a lot of people didn't understand Russell. He was aloof. He wanted nothing to do with the fans. He didn't want to sign autographs. He didn't even particularly care about the city of Boston. He made that very clear. He didn't care about anybody or anything except his teammates and except the Celtics. And so a lot of people thought, okay, Bill Russell was just a kind of a selfish person, flawed person who just happened to be duct taped to an amazing basketball player. But what I realized after looking at Russell really closely was his teammates, the way his teammates talked about him, I knew there was something going on. And the answer in the end was that Bill Russell was one of these characters. He absolutely didn't care about anything but the collective success of his team. And everything he did on the basketball floor, all he did was block shots. He wasn't a great scorer. He wasn't a great ball handler. He never did anything flashy. Everything he did was in the service of winning and the service of his star teammates. They loved him for it. And everything he did inside the locker room was completely selfless. He used to get so nervous before games that he would throw up, you know, before every game, even meaningless games. And if he didn't throw up, his teammates would be like, Russ, go throw up. What's wrong with you? You know, because he was so so focused and so intense and a relentless, relentless player as well. And all of those qualities, the public didn't understand him. They didn't understand how he could be that way. And the problem was we didn't know what we were looking at. We didn't know that we were looking at real, great, enduring leadership. You know, we didn't think that's what it looked like. So he was a mystery. And finally, you know, there was this famous incident where Russell turned down the Hall of Fame. He was elected Hall of Fame. He said, thanks, but I'm not coming. I don't really want to be part of it. And that was an example to people of what is wrong with this guy? Like, why is he so grouchy and angry? But he finally explained years later what was going on. He said, look, I thought the Hall of Fame is silly. Why do you pull one individual out of a team and say, this guy belongs in the Hall of Fame? He felt like his accomplishments were a symbol of team play, not individual play. And that's why he wanted no part of it. This was something, a concept that no one could understand. And as a result, a lot of people didn't appreciate or understand, even like Russell. But in retrospect, he is probably, arguably, the greatest captain in sports history. And we just didn't know what we had.
When you say, who do you think would be the greatest captain in sports history or basketball history in particular, people would probably say Michael Jordan. Why isn't Michael Jordan a great captain? He was the captain.
I've had a lot of tomatoes thrown at me about the Chicago Bulls, and it was one of the biggest eureka moments I've ever seen. I had the same prejudice. In fact, Jordan, I think, was my model before I started this project of leadership in sports. He seemed to be the kind of character you would look for. But what I discovered after looking a lot more closely and talking to his teammates was that, you know, for the first six seasons he was in Chicago, they didn't win. And everyone was saying Michael Jordan's going to be the best player who never won a championship. He wasn't Michael Jordan. Phil Jackson, his coach, was a second-year coach. He wasn't Phil Jackson. He was just a second-year coach. So in 1990, they started the season. I think they were 8-13. They had a really rough start. It looked bad. And Phil Jackson made an incredible announcement. He said that Michael Jordan will now be the co-captain of the Bulls, along with this guy Bill Cartwright. And Bill Cartwright was the center on the team who no one understood this because Jordan hated Cartwright famously because Cartwright had been traded for one of his friends on the team and he had given him a hard time. He'd badmouthed him to the press. He had not thrown him balls when he was open. It had been a terrible relationship. But Cartwright was absolutely one of these characters. He was behind the scenes. He wanted no attention. He could have scored more but didn't. He mentored the young players. He talked to everybody. He was incredibly selfless, played through enormous knee pain his whole career. He was one of these behind-the-scenes, water-carrying characters. Now, look at their record. I mean, you go back and look this up. The day Jackson made the announcement, everything changed. They turned into an incredible winning team. And they went on to win their first NBA championship that season and won two more. Now, Cartwright retired, and ultimately after that, Scottie Pippen and I think Steve Kerr kind of played that role in the team. Jordan got all the credit. He was the superstar, the leader, the man. But really, if you look under the hood of that team, it was this kind of leadership that got them through and turned them into a champion. Now, the only reason they didn't make my top 16 is because, you know what, they don't hold a candle to the Celtics. I mean, they won 6 titles in 8 years. That doesn't hold a candle to 11 out of 13. So, and they didn't have the longevity and the winning streak that the Spurs had for so many years. So, again, they're an amazing team. They could easily fit into this profile, but they didn't do anything that was unique in the history of the NBA.
All right, so these are the 7 traits that we've talked about. I think all of them have come up here. Extreme doggedness and focus in competition, aggressive play that tests the limits of the rules, a willingness to do thankless jobs in the shadows, a low-key, practical, democratic communication style, motivates others with passionate nonverbal displays, strong convictions, courage to stand apart, and emotional control. I guess there's one thing I want to ask about is that aggressive play that tests the limits of the rules, because there is playing angry and there is aggressive play, and aggressive play can be used to motivate, and you find that playing angry is a distraction. What's the difference between those two?
This took a long time for me to unpack because I saw a lot of these captains do things that were really ugly in competition and breaking the rules. And one example, I always talk about a current example, is Tom Brady, who fits his profile, even though his team isn't in the top 16 yet. Deflating the footballs, the famous Deflategate scandal, right? Mm-hmm. I saw that and immediately thought that's classic behavior by these captains. So this is what they do. If they think they can get away with it, they'll push it as far as they can. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not advocating breaking any rules or doing anything unsportsmanlike. But here's what I discovered. I looked at the incredibly aggressive tactics that these captains used and the things they did on the field that didn't seem right. And it took me a long time to figure this out, but there's a lot of research been done on aggression. And, aggression in sports has always had a strange relationship because aggression everywhere else is particularly a bad thing. I mean, it's pretty generally considered a negative thing. But in sports, some aggression is important. I mean, aggression is part of the game. You need it, right? So it never squared perfectly. And finally, researchers started to isolate what I think is the answer. And the answer is that there are really two forms of aggression, and we don't distinguish between them. There's one form that is hostile aggression. That's when you want to hurt somebody. That's when you do something aggressive, and really you're trying to do harm to someone or to stop someone from succeeding. And there's another form, which they call instrumental aggression. This is an aggressive act that may hurt someone, may look exactly like the hostile act, but was actually motivated by helping pursuing a valuable goal, and in this case, winning a game. So you have to look at what they did. And I started to look at it through this lens. I realized that everything, all these aggressive things they did in competition, some of them were really nasty, but you know what? It was never personal, and it was always about helping the team win. Now, the real differentiation point between these captains and everyone else is that they understood that there's something that psychologists call a game frame. And inside the game frame, inside the rules of sports, everything's different. You know, what you can get away with on a field of play is far different than what you could do, in the stands 3 feet away. So they understood that. And within the game frame, they would play to the absolute edge of what's acceptable. But the minute the game was over, and I saw this starkly in many cases, it's like a switch was thrown. And they would go right back to abiding by the rules of polite society. None of these captains ever got in any kind of trouble. I mean, they never did anything off the field that was bad. In fact, they were boring. They were hopelessly boring. They would go home and sleep for 8, 10, 12 hours a night. They didn't go to nightclubs. They didn't do anything. They usually had, families, and they were very private and kept to themselves off the field. They understood that there was a difference. And, too often I think we look at all aggression, we kind of lump it together, and we don't think about, well, what was the motivation behind it? You can't always excuse it. But I think if you understand why it was done and the context in which it was done, then you start to see that sort of aggression is part of great leadership.
All right. So what are the lessons off the playing field for us? I don't think I can take aggression into my news meetings
don't.
Or anything. But what could we take into our workplace?
The first thing I tell people is that if you are looking for a leader of your team, you really have to go in to some time when they're interacting with each other and say, all right, if I was just coming in for the first time and didn't know these people, who's the last person that I would think was the leader of this team? Start there. Because, you know, it's probably not that person, but you're probably closer to the answer than you would be if you came in thinking who's, you know, the leader, capital L. So that's one thing you can do. You know, the other thing is, you know, these people are not obvious and they're hard to find. In fact, if you ask them questions, they might disqualify themselves because if you talk about their accomplishments, they're really going to lay it off on their teammates. They don't like taking credit. They don't want to promote themselves. So you really have to push past that, and you have to look at the way they interact and the decisions they make in a team setting, because all of these traits, these seven traits, the really cool thing about it is that talent and charisma do not matter in this context. These traits are all about behavior. It's about the choices that a leader makes in a team context every day, day in and day out. It's the sum total of every choice they make. And behavior is something we can emulate and something we can change. So we can develop people. We can develop to become better leaders by following these behaviors. And it's a functional kind of management. It's not about grand gestures or shiny people. It's about constantly being on the lookout for what needs to be done and making sure that it gets done.
Sam Walker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Stephanie. It's a great pleasure.
The Captain Class is Sam's book. It's The Captain Class, The Hidden Force That Creates the World's Greatest Teams.